Welcome to The Reiki Show, hosted by Reiki authors Bronwyn and Fran Steiner, founders of the International House of Reiki. Find out more at www.reiki.net.au. Hi, my name is Bronwyn.
And my name is Franz.
And today we have with us H.E. Davy. H.E. Davy is an author and martial arts teacher, and he's also involved in many other areas of Japanese culture and practices, such as Japanese yoga, traditional brush writing and ink painting. But we'll let him tell us all about these different areas and his involvement with that. Welcome, Mr. Davy.
Thank you.
So to begin with, our interest would be, as Reiki is a Japanese practice, we'd like to find out about Japanese practices, and I guess we'd like to know first what your own background is.
Okay, well, it's a fairly long story because I practice several different Japanese art forms. My introduction to the arts of Japan actually came via traditional martial arts. My dad was one of the first Western people to get involved in jiu-jitsu, which he started learning back in 1926. And he later lived in Japan, where he continued to study martial arts. And then at age five, I started practicing jiu-jitsu with him. And since then, I've studied jiu-jitsu in the USA and Japan. And I received the title of Kyoshi from the Kokusai Budoin, which is a Tokyo-based international federation. And Kokusai Budoin more or less defines Kyoshi as comparable to a master's certificate and equivalent to modern ranks of 6th to 8th degree black belt. And I've also received a 7th degree black belt from the Shotokan Martial Arts Association, and I serve on that group's board of directors. The SMAA is basically an international coalition of Japanese and Western martial arts experts. And they've actually got a pretty interesting website. People can visit it at smaa-hq.com. Later in middle school, I started practicing Shinshin Toitsudo, which is a system of Japanese yoga and meditation that was founded by Nakamura Tenpu Sensei. And I think I'm the only American member of Tenpukai, an organization that was established by Mr. Nakamura. And I practiced in Japan and the USA under his senior disciples, including Sawai Asuhiro Sensei and Hashimoto Tetsuichi Sensei. And I've also received pretty extensive instruction in Nakamura Sensei's methods of body work and healing with ki or life energy, which I also teach. And I guess Shinshin Toitsudo has had the biggest influence on me in my writing of any of the Japanese disciplines that I've studied. And if you read my books, you'll see that its principles are found in some form in pretty much everything that I write. I've also studied Shodo, or Japanese brush writing and ink painting. I studied for 20 years under the late Kobara Ranseki Sensei of Kyoto, and I received the top rank in Ranseki Shojuku calligraphy, and I exhibit my artwork every year in Japan, and I've received various awards for those expeditions, including Jun Taisho, which is roughly the Associate Grand Prize. Let's see. Well, as you know, I write, so my articles on Japanese arts and my artwork have appeared in an assortment of American and Japanese magazines and newspapers. I'm the author of Unlocking the Secrets of Aiki Jiu-Jitsu, Brush Meditation, A Japanese Way to Mind and Body Harmony, Japanese Yoga, The Way of Dynamic Meditation, Living the Japanese Arts and Ways, 45 Paths to Meditation and Beauty, The Japanese Way of the Flower, Ikebana is Moving Meditation, and The Japanese Way of the Artist, which is due to come out in July of 2007. And I'm at present the director of the Sennin Foundation Center for Japanese Cultural Arts, and we offer instruction in traditional Japanese systems of yoga and meditation, martial arts, healing arts, and fine arts. And the Sennin Foundation Center is located in the San Francisco Bay Area, and you can find us on the internet at senninfoundation.com. So that's a semi-quick rundown of what I do.
That's pretty impressive, though. Okay, in your books you talk about the way. What do you mean by this?
Well, that's a little difficult to explain briefly, but I'll give it a shot. At their deepest levels, arts like tea ceremony or sado, flower arrangement, kado, calligraphy, shodo, and the martial arts, budo, are all closely related, which is something the average person doesn't necessarily realize or consider, because they look, you know, pretty different outwardly. We wouldn't normally think in Western culture that arranging flowers and swinging a sword have too much that connect them. But despite outward differences, Japanese art share certain aesthetics, and more important, they demand the acquisition of, I guess, related positive character traits for their successful performance. And as you probably noticed when I gave you that brief list of just a few of the Japanese do forms or ways, many of these arts end in the word do, and do means the way, and its use in these names indicates that an activity has gone beyond its utilitarian purpose. It's been raised to the level of art, and even more than that, its students are practicing it as a way of life. So a do is an art that allows us to understand the ultimate nature of the whole of life by closely examining ourselves through a single activity in life. To put it more succinctly, to arrive at the universal through studying the particular. And there's a whole variety of artistic principles and mental states that are universal to all the Japanese ways. One of the most fundamental is coordination of mind and body. And while it's true that not many of us use a calligraphy brush or a Japanese sword or tea ceremony utensils in daily life, by learning how to use those things skillfully, we can enhance our mental and physical well-being. And skill in these arts comes from integrating the mind and body. And the relationship between the mind and body and how to achieve mental and physical harmony is a principal theme in pretty much all of my books. Another point that I think isn't necessarily well understood about the various do is that it's the manner in which we approach the ways that determines what we're going to learn from them. So, as you probably gathered from my perhaps too lengthy explanation of who and what I am, I've spent the majority of my life studying various Japanese art forms. And speaking as somebody that was once very shy, overweight, uncoordinated, severely asthmatic, I can confirm that these things really do offer a tremendous potential for self-transformation. The deliberate, conscious practice of the Japanese do forms really can result in the cultivation of the mind and body, but they provide that potential to us. They don't guarantee it. So in order to fruitfully approach a tea ceremony or Japanese dance or other arts as meditative acts, it's very important to see exactly how they can lead us to this understanding. To be blunt, lots of people arrange flowers, make tea, or practice martial arts without any sudden insights into the nature of living taking place. So what I've attempted to do in my books is to show principles and practices that will allow readers to directly experience these arts as meditation and be able to see how they really function as meditation in sort of a concrete, coherent, and well-organized manner as opposed to something that approximates a fortune cookie philosophy. So that's hopefully an intelligible answer to your question.
Within the way often people practice shugyo, why is that so important?
Well, again, it's a good question. It's not that easy to answer briefly, but the ways are not designed solely to provide instruction in a specific activity, such as arranging flowers or playing the shakuhachi flute. all the ways, given their emphasis on forging the spirit, can be thought of as forms of shugyo. The term shugyo has sort of quasi-religious overtones, and it means roughly austere spiritual practices. The sometimes lengthy meditation periods found in Japanese yoga, or the special winter training that martial arts people do in the dead of winter outside in the snow, are examples of shugyo within the dull forms. I think if you use that term, the average Japanese person maybe has images of somebody, you know, meditating under an icy waterfall. Shugyo is an important part of the dō, and it also offers something important to contemporary society. I think for most of us, you know, our modern technological way of life has brought us pretty far from the way our ancestors used to live. You know, and modern conveniences are great, and they enable us to live life in comfort and safety, and we wouldn't be able to do this podcast if we didn't have 21st century technology. But in pre-modern times, humanity was in closer connection with nature, and inevitably forged a kind of toughness and a strong sense of self-reliance. And as our lives have grown gradually more and more comfortable or more easy, they've also come to lack, in some cases, a certain mental and physical strength and self-reliance. And so our, again, in some cases, over-reliance on technology has occasionally damaged our sense of self-reliance. In the process, I think, at least where I live, you know, even our definition of fun has changed from that of our predecessors. In much of American society these days, hard work is rarely seen as enjoyable. If it's hard, you know, it can't be fun. If it's fun, it isn't work. And in my opinion, that's a problem. In short, by making life too easy, this tends to take us out of touch with nature itself and our own natures. And, of course, I'm not suggesting that we eliminate technology, but within our present-day technological society, we still need very simple, down-to-earth methods, pragmatic methods, to train our minds and bodies to preserve our link to the natural world. And the Japanese arts and ways can help us do this, but only if they're practiced as shugyo, as a kind of spiritual forging. Most of the dō are really not very high-tech. You know, tea ceremony students sit kneeling on fairly hard tatami mats in an old-fashioned tea room. I've yet to be in one that's climate-controlled. And, you know, my own experience with the tea ceremony in the winter was that the first warmth I felt during the ceremony was when I finally got to drink some hot tea. And that may seem kind of harsh, but it's actually kind of neat in that your sense and appreciation of warmth and food and drink is heightened under these sort of circumstances. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's very different from sitting in a heated, vibrating massage chair while you wait around for the microwave to ding and tell you your instant tea is done. So, you know, by the same token, if we look at the Japanese martial arts, in these art forms, we have special training sessions during the hottest time in the summer. And martial artists train their minds and bodies to the limits of their endurance, and sometimes we even find new limits. And we do all of this during the hottest time of the year. And the dojo that you do this in isn't air-conditioned, or you're doing it outside, you know, on a beach. Another example, the late Nakamura Tempu-sensei encouraged his Japanese yoga students to exercise with him wearing only light shorts. He said, you know, this is a means of strengthening the skin and training the body to be adaptable. And they practice indoors and outdoors, winter and summer, all different kinds of weather. Japanese calligraphy students will, at least traditionally, spend hours kneeling on the floor. They're writing antique Japanese poems with an equally antiquated brush. So all of this is pretty low-tech stuff, but these low-tech activities are effective for reconnecting us to nature and for reconnecting us with our own natures. And in this sense, they bring us back to something very elemental, even spiritual in character. Within the Do, we connect with truths that are universal, but that can be relatively easily lost when life gets too easy or we become too insulated from the natural world. So the Do practice as Shugyo enables us to make this kind of reconnection and to practice these different art forms, not simply as utilitarian subjects. So therefore, the tea ceremony or the art of flower arrangement becomes a kind of spiritual practice, a way of training and disciplining our minds and bodies.
The founder of the system of Reiki, on his memorial stone, which was put up 1 year after his death in 1927, it was said that he practiced Shugyo to gain his understanding about the system of Reiki. What would you say would be the way, how would we properly follow the way?
Well, I have to confess to not knowing nearly as much about Reiki as you two do. So I think, you know, when your founder on his tombstone, when it indicates that he practiced Shugyo, this is a fairly common thing to say in Japan. The whole idea is to emphasize that the founder trained very hard and was able to transcend the limitations that ordinary people have. And so it's a fairly common thing to say, but it's nonetheless important in that it's emphasizing that what he was doing or what any of these people that created these different disciplines were doing transcended, again, its utilitarian purpose. They were able to move from the particular to the universal, from the art of healing or the art of calligraphy or the art of flower arrangement to the art of living itself. As far as how we properly follow the way, I'm not sure there's just one way to follow the Do or way of the universe. Each of us has to find the right way to live for ourselves, and this finding is something that's discovered from moment to moment. So while other people's ideas can sometimes be a catalyst that can prompt us to discover or do certain things, I'm not really sure that anyone else can really transmit skill to us or understanding or even effectively tell us how to live. And that includes people like me. Having said that, I think as human beings, we're more alike than we are different. And we all exist within the same universe. So your question is, in a way, what prompted me to write several books. So I probably can't answer it fully, you know, in this limited amount of time, but one point that I would like to try to get across is that naturalness, or shizenteki, is a key element in following the way. So starting in China, with the Taoist emphasis on not interfering with nature, and continuing in the various Japanese Do forms, there's a constant emphasis on being natural and being one with nature. So when you're trying to follow a way or the way or any particular way, if what we're doing or how we're living goes against nature, we're basically out of harmony with the Do or the way of the universe.
You talked about Taoism being practiced in China, and when it came to Japan, how much did it kind of change? Was it adopted to the Japanese culture, or did other Japanese practices slip into that form?
Well, like most things in Japan, it was definitely, for lack of a better term, Japanized. Japanese are very good, as most people know, at importing elements from other cultures and reshaping them to work well within their own culture. Like many aspects of Chinese culture, Taoist concepts eventually came to Old Japan. and Taoist teachings, which are referred to in Japanese as Dokyo, gradually had some influence on Japanese society and arts, if for no other reason than Zen Buddhism was embraced by the samurai class. And while Buddhism originally came from India, it eventually moved to China, where Zen was influenced by Chinese religions, Taoism, Confucianism, and then eventually came to Japan. So there are direct Taoist influences in Japanese culture. There are more indirect influences through Zen. Direct influence took place through interaction with Taoist practitioners, while more indirect influences occurred, I think, via Chinese arts and practices shaped by Taoist principles, and as I just mentioned, through the widespread introduction of Chinese Zen Buddhism, which has, again, Taoist influences. So, Do is the Japanese pronunciation of Dao, the metaphysical force of the Chinese religion of Taoism. And essentially, Taoist philosophy encourages going with the flow of nature. So Taoism came to Japan along with Confucian concepts of etiquette, respect, devotion to tradition and learning. But these Taoist ideas emerged not so much as a distinct religion, as in China, but as ideals applied to the performance of native arts and crafts. And in this sense, these arts were able to go beyond their utilitarian nature, and they eventually became the different Do that we see today, like Sado, tea ceremony, or Shodo, the way of calligraphy. On the other hand, you know, it's a mistake to think that every art whose name includes the designation Do has a deep or specifically Taoist origin. The Japanese have long since come to use the word Do in a fairly generic manner, and though it does have origins in the Chinese Tao and carries a somewhat similar meaning, I think in many Japanese arts, that's pretty much the extent of it. In any case, it's my belief that the Taoist connection isn't always fully explored or acknowledged in writings about the ways of Japan, so I've tried to address this in some of my books. At present, I think the degree to which Taoist principles have been changed in Japan really depends on the art form and the teacher that's teaching it. You know, people tend to think of Japan as being solely populated by Japanese people, but that isn't exactly the case. Chinese and Koreans have lived in Japan for a very long time. So within the Chinese community in Japan, you may be able to get a more Chinese interpretation of Taoist-derived arts.
Could you please tell us how the Japanese explain the word ki?
Okay, you guys are hitting the really hard questions today. I'm not sure there's one universal explanation of ki in Japan. It's a word that's used frequently in Japanese language, but to be honest, I don't think the average person in Japan thinks much about it one way or another. So it's probably easier for me to discuss how I personally interpret ki. Ki, by definition, means roughly life energy, and it refers to the fundamental building block of the universe. You know, that thing that everything emerges from, is animated by, and ultimately returns to at death. Japanese use it in words like tenki, or weather, which is literally the ki of heaven. Byouki, or sickness, which is literally sick ki. Kijoku, or willpower, which is key power. So it's used in a very wide variety of words, many of which are very mundane, and then some of which, like tenshi no ki, the key of the universe, are not. Tenshi no ki could be interpreted as being the equivalent to God. So this is a word that has wide-ranging implications within Japanese culture. And it implies something that's really kind of all-encompassing. Many Japanese arts, and especially ways, mention ki as an aspect of their teachings. In some arts, ki and its relationship to the unity of mind and body are also explored. However, this exploration has commonly occurred on what is largely an intuitive level. In other words, it involves years of experimental practice, years of trial and error. And the late Nakamura Tenpu Sensei, founder of the Shinshin Toitsu Japanese yoga system, was trained in Western medicine. And he used his medical and scientific training to evolve a way of very pragmatically, consciously, and rationally studying qi and mind and body coordination. I've been very influenced by his approach, and his teachings echo those of the creators of a number of do, including calligraphy, flower arrangement, martial arts, that type of thing. The use of the word qi in my books might be a little different than from what you've read elsewhere, in that I've made a deliberate attempt to point at something that's all-encompassing. As a result, it's ultimately beyond description, and yet it's still perceivable in everyday life. And I know that if you're not familiar with this way of looking at things, qi can seem difficult to understand. Maybe looking at qi from a different perspective might make it easier to understand. And to accomplish that, sometimes I make reference to what I've been reading about in terms of physics in the last few years. You know, physicists say that every natural phenomenon is made up of basically variable mixtures of energy and matter. These combinations constantly disintegrate into their components, and then they reintegrate to create fresh phenomena. So matter can be transformed into energy and energy into matter, and neither one can be absolutely destroyed. The entirety of all matter and energy has remained constant since the universe was born. And so energy and matter, the essence of essentially everything that exists, are everlasting. And from this viewpoint, every part of life that comes from the combination of matter and energy is also infinite and eternal. In recent years, a sort of union of quantum physics and mysticism has been frequently a hot topic in popular media. And I find all of that very interesting, but I have to confess, I was an art major, so I'm definitely not an expert on physics. But I think I can speak broadly on the general subject. And on the basis of the nature of energy and matter that I just mentioned, I use the word qi to indicate an indestructible union of matter and energy, something that's both ever-changing and constant. So in this context, qi describes the basic essence of existence, something which experiences continual integration, disintegration, and then recreation. So in this sense, qi can be understood as the connective tissue of the universe, and more specifically, as the component that joins mind and body. It's more or less non-dualistic in nature, and as a result, beyond description, but it isn't beyond experiencing. And it's also not exclusively spiritual or non-physical. Qi is no more spiritual than it is material. Again, it's actually all-encompassing. The body is qi as much as the mind is qi, in that every cell in the body exhibits a metabolic process. It's alive, and thus has life energy. So the body is a visible form of qi, whereas the mind is refined, invisible qi. And this is an explanation that I found works relatively well for Western people, and it's something that, to some degree, I borrowed from Nakamura Sensei's Japanese yoga.
Yeah. Often within the explanation of qi or universal energy or life force, the Japanese use the concepts of heaven, Earth and Humankind. What, can you explain more about these terms for us?
Yes, sure. Well, there is a kind of ancient or classical trinity of Ten Qi Jin. Ten meaning heaven, Qi meaning earth, and Jin is humanity. Ancient Japan was very heavily influenced by Chinese culture. And in old Chinese thought and books, you're going to see references to heaven, earth, and humanity. And I think this is probably because back then, people didn't necessarily think in terms of being surrounded on all sides by an endless universe. They thought more in terms of heaven or the universe as being above them, with a flat earth below them. In this context, humanity was suspended between heaven and earth. However, today we have a different and more scientific understanding of our relationship to the universe, and I think it's important to note that while the word Tenchi literally means heaven and earth in Japanese, most people today take this to just mean the universe. So practically speaking, the classical heaven, earth, humanity trinity can be explained as simply emphasizing that human beings are linked to the universe and they should follow the way of the universe. That said, some Japanese art forms do make greater use of this heaven, earth, humankind concept. My wife has a teaching certificate in Ikei Noble flower arrangement, and she was actually the co-author of The Japanese Way of the Flower with me. And she emphasized to me that in Japanese flower arrangement, it's not unusual to arrange the flowers and plant material so that one grouping represents heaven, another one represents earth, still another one represents human beings. But like in all Japanese art forms, the idea here in flower arrangement is just that people should exist in harmony with the universe. So it's actually a very simple idea.
That is the end of part one of our interview with H.E. Davy. Stay tuned for next week for part two.